Sorry, folks, I just had to do a quick run, but I am back. Okay, so I think we're ready to go. Can you hear me? Okay, let's make sure that I'm unmuted, my video is on, I'm recording, check, 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 we're ready to go. Before I start, any questions, since this is the second to last session of the class, if you have questions about your project, I'll have office hours tomorrow and on Friday, so you can drop by, and I will try to extend the office hours to go as long as I need to on Friday, so if you have any questions, we'll get them out of the way. But any kind of quick questions before we get started? Okay, so let's go to the races. I sent you a test yesterday. I am a realist at this point. I know at this point you're probably not reading my emails and you have enough stuff to do that you don't want to do one more thing. But I sent you a test and I said, if you can't take this test, I know most of you might not have taken the test, but I think that in today's class, you'll be able to do the test in real time. So I want to talk a little bit about acquisitions. A few years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, the dean's office reached out to me and said, would you teach an M&A class? And I said, what would I teach? Because after the first session, I'd run out of material. And they said, but isn't M&A all about valuation? I said, the valuation portion of M&A is very minimal. I can get it done in a session. And the rest is about deal making, how to structure the deal, how to do that. And I'm not interested in the deal making part. So what I'd like to focus on is the valuation part of M&A. So I'll give you a little bit of history to this particular title, because this particular title has got me a lot of blowback, especially in these politically correct days. So about 15 or 20 years ago, a student of mine set up a business. He ran executive seminars for CFOs and CEOs. So he was New York based. He was running a seminar for CFOs of companies that did a lot of acquisitions. For lack of a better term, let's call them serial acquirers. Yeah. So he calls me and he says, I'm doing the session for CFOs of serial acquirers. Would you be willing to come in and talk to them? And I said, are you sure you're talking to the right guy? Because you all know my biases against acquisitions. I think more value is destroyed through acquisitions than any other single corporate action. And he said, no, I want you to come and talk to them. Because for the rest of the day, they're going to be hearing from investment bankers in M&A. And you know what investment bankers and M&A think about M&A, right? It's basically you want as much activity as possible. And he said, I'd like you to come in and give them a counterview about M&A. And I said, okay, I'll come. But don't expect me to kind of toe the line and tell them M&A is great. So I came in and I put up my title slide and they could already tell where I was coming from. And the title for my session, which I've kind of preserved, is Acquirers Anonymous, 7 Steps to Sobriety. And there's a reason I picked that title. I believe that acquisitions are an addiction. What I mean by that is when companies start to grow through acquisitions, it's very difficult for them to go back to growing the old-fashioned way. What's the old-fashioned way? You take project after project. You've got to do your homework on small projects. It's so much more fun to do a big deal, a multi-billion dollar deal. And once you get started, it becomes very difficult for you to step away from that addiction. And like every addiction, there are a whole group of people who make money on that addiction and keep feeding you the drug, right? And in the case of M&A, guess who feeds the addiction? You got consultants who come in and tell you, you got to acquire your way to grow. You got bankers who find a feed. So you have acquired, you have consultants, you have bankers, you have an ecosystem that encourages it. So already you can see that what I'm going to talk about in the context of acquisitions is going to come from a fairly cynical perspective, which is that in most acquisitions, you'll get a lot of deal making, but very little thought about whether the acquisition makes sense. So here's how I'd like to structure today's session. I want to start some bad news about acquisitions. I'm going to lay out what I see as the evidence in acquisitions, and it's not pretty. I'm going to talk about what happens around the announcement of the acquisition and what happens afterwards, whether the synergy and the control you talk about actually shows up. And we're going to see very quickly that the evidence is not supportive of the notion that acquisitions are a good thing. And then I'm going to posit that if we've known for a long time that acquisitions don't create value, and study after study going back 50 years establishes this, why do we keep doing this? Why does the process never seem to change? And I'm going to make the argument that there's something flawed in the process. And I'm going to take you through a series of tests on a typical acquisition so you can see the kinds of mistakes that feed into acquisition valuation and where those mistakes come from. So let's start with what happens on the acquisition announcement day to the two players in an acquisition. Remember, there are two players, an acquiring company and a target company. And in this graph, basically what I've done is around the day of the acquisition, which is the day zero that you see in this graph, I'm looking at what happens to the target company, that's a red line, and what happens to the acquiring company. So if you're given a choice between being a shareholder in a target company and a shareholder in an acquiring company, this is no contest. We can see who the winners are. Typically, target company stock prices jump about 20% on the announcement of an acquisition. But there's a very interesting drift that seems to happen before the acquisition announcement date. So if you look at day zero, and you look at the 15, 20 days before the acquisition, the price seems to drift up on target companies. Now you can view this in one of two ways. As evidence that markets are remarkably perceptive and they can see what's coming. Or a more cynical side says, somebody's leaking information out about the acquisition and people are making money. I think there's more credence to the second viewpoint than the first one because there is clearly a drift up. But even with the drift up, clearly target company shareholders are the winners. Acquiring company shareholders on average tend to see a loss of about 2% of value. So you're saying that's not bad. Target companies go up 20%. Acquiring companies go down 2%. This must be a net plus, right? But is it? What do I have to factor in when I look at that difference to explain what happens around acquisitions? Barry?
I'm assuming that the market is factoring in the 20% growth in value of the target. And like,
no, wait. The market is just factoring in whatever price.
And still giving you a company discount.
Exactly. The premium that they're going to pay. Right?
So I'm assuming the acquirer is falling in 2% value even with the increase in value of the target.
Because of the increased value. And here's how you reconcile the two. Shashanka?
No, I was thinking maybe the acquirers are larger in size. So
on average, an acquiring company is about 10 to 15 times larger than a typical target company.
So that's why the discrepancy in...
Here's the cynical side. If the target company is up 20%, the acquiring company is down 2%, but the typical acquiring company is 10 times larger than the target company. You know what this graph tells me? That M&A collectively might be a zero-sum game, and whoever wins, somebody else is losing an equivalent amount. It's an incredibly cynical view, but at least based on the acquisition day behavior, that's what I get out of M&A. Collectively, there seems to be no value. Simon?
Yeah, I was gonna ask, does the target price reflect like the upside potential for being acquired while the bidder price reflect kind of like the risk of it going wrong more and dragging down the combined company?
It could, but in a sense, it's also, it must be one-sided, right? Because risk can cut both ways. If it's just mistakes were being priced in, you shouldn't expect to see a drift down across all M&A. The fact that there's a drift down across all M&A and acquiring companies must mean only one thing. On average, acquiring companies pay too much. That's really the only reason, right? Because no matter what the story is, at the end of the game, markets have to react to whatever the announcement is and what the target price is. And based on what markets see at the time of the acquisition, they don't see value creation, they see value transfer from the acquiring company shareholders to the target company shareholders. Now, if you ask the acquiring company's managers, I showed this graph to the acquiring company CFOs. You know what the reaction was? They don't see what we do. They, being the stockholders, don't see what we do. And you know what the CFOs see? They see projections of the future and all the great synergy and the control value they're going to get. They said, they don't see what we see. So I'm going to do, show you the results of a follow-up study. Now, in these follow-up studies, what they do is they say, okay, let's not focus on the acquisition day. Let's see what happens in the years after. So McKinsey, for instance, waits 5 years after an M&A and asks two questions. Did the return on capital on the acquisition exceed the cost of capital? That question sounds familiar. That's a question that every company is supposed to ask about every project. So they ask, does the return on capital exceed the cost of capital? Is it a positive net present value project? And the second question they ask is more of a relative question. They said, if acquisitions create synergy and they make the acquiring company stronger, then over time, acquiring companies should do better relative to their peer group than they would have without the acquisition. So they compare the acquiring company after an acquisition to the rest of the peer group to see if their margins increase, their returns increase. So does the return on capital exceed the cost of capital? Are you doing better than the peer group? You know what McKinsey has, they've done this study, I think, 4 or 5 times over the last 5 decades. Every time they do these studies, they find the same thing. Most companies fail at least one test and many fail both. In other words, most acquisitions, the return on capital, even counting in the synergy and all the great stuff, doesn't exceed the cost of capital. And there is little evidence that acquiring companies become better relative to the peer group, at least on average, after the acquisitions. So McKinsey studies, even if you wait years after the deal, find little evidence of synergy and control value. KPMG in the late 90s asked a much more focused question. They said synergy seems to be this big motive in mergers. And they said, in what percentage of mergers globally do you actually see synergy? So what they did was they looked at the combined company after the deal, waiting years to allow the synergy to show up, to see if synergy actually shows up as higher growth or higher margins or lower costs. And here's what they found. In about 16% of all mergers, they found synergy, 1 in 6. In half of all mergers, they found nothing. It was zero effect. So you combine the firms, there's no increase in margins, no increase in growth. So you're saying that 16% plus 50%, what about the other third? In the other third, they actually found reverse synergy. You know what reverse synergy is? Two companies with 10% growth rates come together, and the combined company starts growing at 7%. That's a very perverse consequence, but whether it's because of cultural clashes or some kind of problems in the combined company, they find reverse synergy. That's a pretty negative result as well. And here's the most damning indictment of acquisitions. Do you know that half of all acquisitions are reversed within 10 years of the deal? Which is the ultimate admission on the acquirer's part. Hey, it didn't work out. So you buy a company and you say, I'm selling it 7 years later. Hey, you're telling me the deal didn't work out. So the bottom line is, whether you look at the acquisition announcement date or years after, the results are the same. Most deals don't work out. I'm not saying not every deal is a failure, but most deals don't work out. Now, much of the earlier part, the studies were of U.S. companies with M&A in the U.S. because this is where M&A was, you saw the most activity with M&A. So in 1980 or 1990, if you saw an acquisition of an emerging market company, the emerging market company was usually the target company, and a U.S. or a European company is the acquiring company. Now, of course, the tide has shifted. Now you have emerging market companies capable of acquiring developed market companies. So in India, for instance, the Tata Group has been very active in going out and acquiring European and US companies. Tata Steel bought Cora Steel. Tata Tea bought, you know, Tetley. But there are other US Indian companies that have now become acquirers. And I have some bad news for you. If you think the disease that I just described by looking at US companies, they tend to overpay, it's restricted to the US, think again. This is actually a study that looked at Indian companies that are acquirers. And it looked at stock prices for the acquiring company. Forget about the target company, because we know what's going to happen there. For the acquiring company in the month of the announcement, so that's month zero, the months after, up to 20 months. So here's month zero, the acquiring company, Indian company announces an acquisition. Initially, the stock price reaction is positive. This is the cumulative price reaction. It continues to rise. It peaks around 2 months after the deal. And then people start to have second thoughts, and you can start to see the returns start to slide. About a year after the deal, when you look at the stock price of the Indian acquirer, it's actually lower than it was before the acquisition. And if you look 20 months after, the stock is down 3%. There is something in this process that cuts across geographies that goes to being an acquiring company, where it seems like you're more likely to overpay on deals. You're more likely to overstate synergy and control benefits, and have a really tough time delivering on those benefits. And this has been true for about 40, I mean, there have been, these studies go back to the 1980s. We've known for a long time that the process is delivering bad results. But here's the puzzle. There's nothing that seems to change. The process continues to deliver bad results. And if the definition of insanity is you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome, there's something insane about this process. So that's what I'm going to start with. There's something flawed about this process because it keeps delivering bad outcomes. So I want to focus on the process. And I've talked about this before, but Julieta, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm just curious. I get that the premium and the overpaying by the acquiring, but like, why is the targets always appreciating? What if we had like a good company being bought out by a bad company that's going to...
Pause right there. How do you buy out? What do you have to start with? How do you buy out another company? You can't pay below market price. You can't pay market price. You got to pay a premium on the market price. So almost by definition, the target company stock price has to go up, otherwise the deal won't go through. Why would shareholders sell if you don't offer a premium?
No, I get the premium, but like, what if the target is a really good company being bought by a bad company?
Well, the premium over the market price. The premium is not over fair value. The premium is over the market price. If you're arguing that maybe you're still getting a good deal because these companies were undervalued, that should then show up in the acquiring company's stock price, right? Because then you're getting good deals. So this premium is over the market price. So almost by definition, the target company should see a jump in the price on the acquisition announcement. You can't do a deal by offering a discount on the market price. I think what you're talking about is the value of the company. And we'll talk about that as a potential motive for acquisitions. Maybe you can find undervalued companies. But clearly, these acquiring companies are not doing it because you should then see it in their stock price and in the results after.
Thank you.
Yeah. So here's what I'm going to do.
Another quick question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So yeah. Jose asked something similar in the chat, but even if companies don't appear to outperform on an ROIC basis, wouldn't you want to evaluate what would have happened if they had not done the merger?
So, yes, because like, let's suppose those are called defensive acquisitions. Can I hold off on that? Were you saying, well, if I hadn't done that, things would have been even worse?
Sure.
We'll talk about that because that is a motive for your mergers. It's actually a very bad place you are as a business model. Because the only way you can keep going as a company is by overpaying for other companies or earning a return capital less than the cost of capital. My advice to you is maybe you should start thinking about shrinking as a company. And getting out of this business rather than staying in. But you're right. You often see defensive deals where people say, if I don't do it, terrible things are going to happen to me. Therefore, I'm going to do it anyway. So we talk about that motive and why that can get you into serious trouble. But we'll come back to it later in the session. Okay? Shashanka?
So about... 10 years down the road, I think you said a lot of companies that are merged would have split again, but cannot...
You mean that you're getting rid of the original acquisition, you divested that company.
Yeah, exactly. But that can also be because they have performed well, and sometimes the kind of spin-offs happen.
You mean like a spin-off of a business?
Yeah.
That's not 99% of mergers. Maybe if you're a private equity guy, that's how you think, but 99% of mergers. Your objective is not to buy another company, fix it, and spin it off, right? So it's very, very uncommon when you see mergers between two corporates that's the end game.
Okay. Yeah.
So private equity, I think that's a different motive. That's a value of control. We'll talk about the value of control and why your odds might be a little better if that's your plan.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Sammy, you have a question?
Yes. Hi. Hi, Sternies. Okay. So, what about assets acquisition? So, I'm not acquiring the whole firm.
I think your odds improve substantially if you're acquiring an asset or even a division of a company. You know what? Because you don't pay market price plus. You pay estimated value plus. The problem with acquiring public companies is you always have to pay market price plus. And that's the point I was making with Julieta. That reduces your odds dramatically. But your odds get much better if you're buying private businesses, divisions of companies, or individual assets.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I'm, yeah, go ahead. You had another question?
No, I was saying thank you.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is take you through what I call the seven deadly sins in acquisitions. Right? And I list them out and then I'll go through them in detail. The first is what I call risk transference, where you as a safe company buy a risky company and you think you can transfer your safety to them. And you'll see very quickly what I mean by this with a very simple example. The second sin is what I call debt subsidies. Here's what happened. You're an acquiring company. You have a really good bond rating. You're able to borrow money at a really low rate. And you use that as a justification for paying a premium on a target company. Again, it sounds abstract, but I'll give you an example of how this plays out. The third is what I call autopilot control. I talked about this early in the class about how in acquisitions, people, you value a target company and then you pay a premium, a 20% control premium. I'm going to talk about where that 20% shows up from, why it's a terrible way to do acquisitions, to pay a 20% control premium, and what the true value of control is. Then I want to talk about synergy. There's a canard that we in valuation think synergy is worth nothing. That is not true. Synergy can be worth a lot of money, but for it to pay off, you got to pay less than that value. So I'm going to talk about valuing synergy and why it's so difficult to lay claim on that synergy. Fifth, I'm going to talk about pricing in the context of target companies. M&A is a pricing game. Why? Because to buy a company, you've got to price it. And the pricing is often based on very biased samples and very biased multiples. There's a lot of bias in pricing in acquisitions, and I'll talk about where the bias comes from. The sixth problem is, I think, a generic problem with acquisitions, which is people decide to do something, then they look for justification. What I mean by that is the CEO of a company decides to do for acquisition, then he goes looking for cover for that decision and how that can get you into trouble. And finally, I'm convinced that the acquisition process has no accountability. What I mean by that is if you take a $10 million project and you screw up, you get fired. You take a $10 billion acquisition and you screw up, you get promoted. Don't ask me why that happens, but there's something in this process that eliminates accountability. So I'm going to use a very simple example to illustrate these seven sins. And what I'd like you to do is keep a running tab on which tests you pass, because I'm going to do it as a series of seven tests. Which tests you pass and which tests you fail. And are any of you planning to work in M&A after you graduate? Any M&A, potential M&A bankers in this group?
Yep.
Julieta? Okay. So if you're going to go into M&A, I'd like you to kind of have some introspection, because these are things you're going to run into out there. So let's start with a very simple target company. So here's what the target company looks like. It's got $100 million in revenues, $20 million in operating income, and $12 million in after-tax operating income. Assume that this company can generate this $12 million in after-tax operating income every year with no growth. So $12 million, $12 million, $12 million year after year. Its cost of equity is 20%, and it's all equity funded. What is the value of this firm? First, what are your cash flows going to be? I've given you after-tax operating income, but normally we subtract out reinvestment. But how much will this company need to reinvest?
Zero.
Zero? And why zero?
There's no growth.
But no growth. So that made our life easy. So basically, $12 million is your free cash flow to the firm. What's your cost of capital? It's equal to your cost of equity because you have no debt. So if 12 million is your cash flow every year forever, and 20% is your cost of capital, your value as a firm is going to be 60 million? Rami? Perry, how do we get to 60 million?
I agree, Rami. Is this the 12 divided by 20%?
That's it. 12 divided by 0.2. Everybody with me so far? Juliana, agree?
Yeah. 60 million?
So 60 million is my target for. So I'm going to play the role of an eager banker, and I'm going to try to get you to pay more. And I want you to tell me at every step in this process what's wrong with my logic. So here's my first trap. You're the acquiring company. You're in a safe business. You have a cost of equity of 10%. Okay? So I tell you, what's the value of the target firm to you? What's the value?
120.
Yeah. Rami, you said 120, so I'm going to put you on the spot because you are my perfect target. So Rami, how do you get the 120?
Well, I'm assuming that the banker is going to try to use the cost of equity of the parent to value it.
Okay. So, but do you think that's the right thing to do?
No, that's definitely the wrong thing to do.
Okay. So tell me why it's wrong, because half of all M&A valuations that I see use the acquiring company's cost of equity.
So the reason why it's wrong is because we should be using the cost of equity that pertains to the riskiness of the revenues and cash flows of the entity that we're buying.
Absolutely. It's capital budgeting 101, right? The discount rate for a project and its cash flow should reflect the risk of the project, not the risk of the entity looking at it. It might sound like I'm being internally inconsistent because we're in private company valuation. I said the value of a private company lies in the eyes of the beholder. But that was not because the beta of the private company was varying. It's because what you saw is really dependent on how diversified you were. So, but here you're talking about two public companies. You should never be using the acquiring company's cost of equity to justify the valuation of a target company. But as I said, half of all deals, this is exactly what you see. And you know what's going to happen if you do it? Every risky company is going to look undervalued to you. AT&T almost drove itself down, it drove itself into a ditch in the 1990s by doing this. This is a safe company, it said we have a low cost of equity. And here's the logic that leads you into this ditch. You say, I am raising the capital, this is my cost of equity. Why shouldn't I use that to value a target company? Because what your cost of equity is has nothing to do with what you use as a cost of equity in valuation. That is supposed to reflect the risk of the investment you're taking, not the risk of the company looking at it. So I want to make sure because as I said, this is such a common mistake. I want to make sure that A, you understand it, and B, you can explain it to somebody doing the wrong thing as to why using the acquiring company's cost of equity will lead you down the wrong path. Your value as a target firm will still be 60 million, even though you as an acquiring company might be a really safe company with a really low cost of equity. Any questions on that?
Professor.
Go ahead, Andres.
Yeah, didn't we discuss when we talked about valuing private companies that the cost of capital of the acquirer was a relevant variable in computing the value?
No, not the cost of equity. Basically, I said the diversification status of the acquirer will be a relevant variable. So it's actually, let's say you're a private company, right? The acquirer is not a cost of capital, it's a potential buyer. And I said how diversified the potential buyer will be will affect how much they can pay for you. So if you're a steel company, I still use a steel beta, but the total beta that I use will be different depending on whether you're fully diversified, partially diversified, or completely undiversified.
Got it.
So there, the potential buyer's diversification status. And even there, I said, if you can find the best buyer, that best buyer is going to be a company that's, you know, that doesn't have a diversification issue. So in a sense, you can reconcile the two because you're talking about two different scenarios. It's still the risk of the target company. But there, because you're a private company and your potential buyer is not diversified, you might not be able to just charge for market risk.
Got it. Okay.
Now let's load up the plate, right? So everybody with me that we should still be using the 20% cost of equity? Okay, so let's move on to the next test.
And you would never, You would never make the you would never make the case that the target company becomes less risky as a result of the acquisition.
Yeah, because the only risk you can eliminate is what kind of risk? Diversifiable risk, right? So in a sense, I can make your firm-specific risk go down. But if you define market risk correctly, by definition, you can't reduce it.
Right.
So, and that's why with public companies, it's such an ironclad rule that you always stay with the target company when you talk about estimating cost of equity.
Got it. Thank you.
So now let's assume that as an acquiring company, I have access to cheap debt. Why? Because I have a really good rating, I've been around a long time, and I've been very careful in, as a custodian of my stockholders' wealth. So I have access to debt at 4%, and I'm going to borrow half the money that I need to do this deal from debt at 4%. Let's say that's my after-tax cost of debt. For the moment, let's assume my cost of equity stays at 20%. I would have to unlever and re-lever, but let's leave the cost of equity at 20%. Half my money comes from equity, half from this cheap debt. Now, would I be willing to pay more for the target firm? And lead me through the mechanics. If you were just doing your cost of capital mechanically, what will happen to your cost of capital now? It's going to be 50% times 20%, the cost of equity, 50% times 4. So basically, it's going to be 12% is your cost of capital, right? So if I just plug the numbers in, half from debt, half from equity, 20 and 4, I get a 12% cost of capital. I plug the 12% cost of capital, I get $100 million value for the target company. I get ready to pay the extra $40 million. Remember, it was $60 million before, now it's $100 million. Is that the right thing to do? Am I doing the right thing here by attaching $100 million value? Perry, you said no. Tell me why it's not the right thing.
I don't think it's even 60 is the right thing. I think if you're putting in debt, you should actually see at what cost can the target acquire debt, and then hypothetically assume the target can acquire.
That's a different question, right? Let's assume the target here could not borrow money. Let's make it a very stark case.
Then again, you don't give the privilege of the acquirer to the target.
You see what Perry is saying, which is if I pay the extra $40 million, here's what I'm doing. I'm taking something that I've earned, right, which is this great rating and debt capacity, and I'm transferring wealth, $40 million, to the target company shareholders for something that did absolutely no role in creating. There's a very simple rule in M&A. Render unto the target company shareholders that which is theirs and not a penny more. If you pay a premium, you're paying a premium for something that the target company shareholders had no role in creating. So again, when you do cost of cap for target companies, I've seen bankers use the acquiring company's cost of debt and how much debt they're going to use. I've actually seen target companies value with 100% debt ratio. You see how you get into this trap? The acquiring company, if it's a big company, can actually borrow the entire amount to do an acquisition. And here's what the banker does. He says 100% of the money is coming from debt. It costs me 2% to borrow money. Therefore, my cost of capital. If I'm a target company shareholder, I'm doing a J. This is as great as it can get for me. So when you do cost of capital calculations for target companies, don't put in your cost of debt and the debt you actually use on the deal, because God only knows what you're paying as a subsidy there. Darshan?
So I was wondering whether, so in a perfect market, whenever you acquire a risky company, your cost of debt theoretically, as an entire company, should go up, because
assuming that are you borrowing money to do the acquisition as well, or is this your original debt?
Yeah, let's assume that we maintain the cost of like capital structure for both companies the way it was, and if we just take over the risky company, technically the debt cost of debt by the bank should go up. But assuming that you are in a capital market which is like frothy and does not price in the risk in that way and sees that the cost of debt does not change, would you still not give that acquirer's cost of debt?
So you're saying if there's a market mistake, your equity value will go up, why not pay that as a premium? Isn't that a particular, I would think that's a very dangerous reason for paying.
But the way I see it is that large groups get away with borrowing more than they should be able to, and at a cheaper price than they should be able to price precisely because they're able to, you know, control their negotiations with the bankers.
Let me ask you a question. Why overpay for a target firm then? If that is the source of your value creation, if the market is not assessing risk properly, why don't you just borrow money and buy back your own stock?
Well, right? Yeah, I mean,
because the friction you're pointing to is the fact that markets are not assessing your default risk correctly, and therefore you're able to borrow money at a lower rate. I can go along, but why overpay on an acquisition just because you have that capacity to borrow money? Just borrow the money and buy back your own stock.
Well, it wouldn't be overpay if I guess that my cost of debt will be X after the acquisition, and if I just use that cost of debt.
But let's suppose your target that this is the reason you're paying a premium. I'm saying don't pay a premium. Just do whatever you're planning to do in terms of borrowing. But go out and buy your stock. That way you're doing a zero net present value investment. You're still getting that increase in value because people are underestimating your default risk. I don't see why you need to even bring an acquisition into that process to be able to claim that increase in value.
Yeah, I was looking at this from the point perspective of how we assess the private company investors, because, I mean, if they are able to get away with, the pricing or the factors that market is currently, I mean, the smaller company is not able to get access to, I mean, why wouldn't we be able to use that to pump up our value?
In general, doing acquisitions because you hope to take advantage of market mistakes is a very finite gain, because one day markets wake up and you don't want acquisitions. If you're doing acquisitions for the right reasons, you don't want it to be driven by market mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the fair value of the company would be different from what I can maximum pay, but I mean, that would be different. I mean, I could theoretically raise the price that I could pay maximum. In that sense,
you could, but I'm saying you're doing it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I agree in that sense, but I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So we'll come back to it, because as I said, it's a pricing game, and when it's a pricing game, you're going to find reasons to justify it. And this might be one of those reasons. The market won't see it and we'll pass it by.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
I don't know if these concepts are related, but on Monday we talked about how when two unrelated companies are merged, right, you'll see the you'll see the equity value of the combined.
There's a wealth transfer. Right. There's a wealth transfer from either the equity to the debt you have the company become riskier afterwards, or from, so basically it depends on which direction you're going. Are you becoming safer or riskier? It is related. There's a reason you might do a bad deal to make your equity investors worse off. I'm sorry, better off, because of the risk transfer.
Right. And so my understanding
is always,
I was just going to say, my understanding of how that works is because there is risk that is diversified away, or because the pro forma company has more borrowing power, the value of the debt in a sense goes up, which is how the risk gets transferred to the bondholders.
But if your end game is increasing the value of equity, not the value of the firm, you can see all kinds of transactions, including the one that was just described of, let me take advantage of the debt market, because eventually what you're doing then is saying, look, I'm willing to accept a less valuable firm, but my equity is going to be worth more because of the wealth transfer that happens within the firm. Right? But that's a very different rationale than saying this is a good deal. It increases my value as a combined company.
Yeah. But generally, you shouldn't assume that the cost of capital should be lower in the combined firm.
It depends on what the two companies basically bring in, right? You can't assume that the combined company's cost of capital will be lower, because if the cost of capital is computed using betas and non-diversifiable risk components, there's no ex-ante reason why combining two companies is going to give you a benefit in terms of lower cost of capital. Just be a weighted average of the two companies.
Right, got it. Thanks.
Just to clarify, so using the cost of debt of the acquirer would be the same thing as using its cost of equity instead of the targets?
Exactly. It gives you the same kind of subsidy. It's a bad practice.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Shashanka?
Yeah. So in this case, if the acquirer pays 100, has the acquirer created $40 of value and transferred all of that to the target, or
can
has
I give
it?
You the red? Can I give you? Yeah. It depends on whether the acquirer had excess debt capacity. If you have excess debt capacity, borrowing money increased your value, but that had nothing to do with the acquisition. And if the company didn't have excess debt capacity, there was no value created. You just paid $40 million for something that the target company had nothing to do, and there was no collective value created. So that's why I would be so cautious about paying the $40 million, is not that it's a value created for the acquiring company that you're giving away to the target company. There might be no value created in the first place. You just have this illusion of creating value because you took your cost of debt and plugged it into an acquisition and hoped and prayed that your overall cost of debt would not change after the deal.
Okay. And if the reason that value destruction would come through would be through increased cost of capital for the firm, I guess, right?
It'll show up as a reduction in the value of your overall company, because now, in a sense, you've created a riskier business. And this goes back to the early point that Darshan raised, which is the riskier company, when those banks come back and reassess your rating, it's like, let's do a what if. Let's say Disney buys Twitter, right? And it uses its cost of debt in valuing Twitter. 6 months from now, a year from now, when the bond market looks at Disney, it's going to see a more risky company, right? Because you bought a more risky business in bed. So my guess is your cost of debt is going to start to rise, and then you're going to see the effect play out. It might take a while for it to show up, but that is where you're going to see the pain play out, is as a higher cost of debt and a higher cost of capital because you did this acquisition with debt that you thought was cheap.
Yeah, got it. Thank you.
So now let's talk about control premiums, right? So if you go to work in an M&A group anywhere in the world, you'd be told to value target company and add 20%. You'd be told it's a control premium. If you ask people, where did that control premium come from? Many of them will not have the answer, so I'm going to give away the original source of this 20% control premium. There's a database called MergerStat. In fact, you have access to it, I think, at Stern if you dig deep enough through the databases. And MergerStat is a very simple database. It's a database of every single acquisition done. It used to be just the US, but now globally. And what it lists is the market price of the target company before the acquisition and the actual price at which it was acquired. So there are thousands of deals here. And in every company, you can see the original market price and the price at which the company was acquired. And they compute a premium. What is this premium? Basically, it's a premium that acquirers paid to buy target companies. And that average number globally, historically, has been about 20%. Now, do you see where the 20% control premium comes from? People take that database and they say, on average, acquirers paid 20% more than the market price. That's a premium. So far, I'm with them, but it's also a control premium. I don't know why it has to be a control premium. Because when you pay more than the market price, you're paying it not just for control, you're paying it for synergy, you're paying it for tax benefits, and you might be paying it because you're stupid, right? Because if you overpay, well, guess where it goes? It goes into that 20% premium. So to take this empirical number, the 20% premium that acquirers come in and call it a control premium and say you're going to pay that as a premium on the target company you're looking at, strikes me as incredibly dangerous. So whenever I bring this up with bankers, their pushback is, but don't you think control is value? And they say, it depends. He said, it depends on what? Let me give you a simple example. Let's take that company that you just saw. It had a 20% operating margin. That gave you the 20 million in operating income on revenues of 100 million. Let's suppose that if you ran the company, you could have a 30% margin. So your after-tax operating income instead of 12 million could be 18 million. Is there a value to control in this company? Absolutely. And I'll tell you exactly how much it's going to be. If I revalue the company with $18 million in cash flows instead of 12 million, I get a $90 million value for the company. That's $30 million higher than the $60 million, there is a control premium. The value of control comes from the fact that this company is badly managed and badly run. In fact, if this target company were already perfectly managed and perfectly run, there is no control premium. The value of control is not something you pay over the market price. It's what you pay because you think you can run the company better. But unfortunately, as with much else in M&A, this has become a rule of thumb, 20%, 25%. And there are so many rules of thumb in acquisitions that you've got to be constantly asking, where did that come from? We're going to come back and talk about the value of control much more in the last session. And I'm going to talk about voting shares and non-voting shares in the context. But the value control is definitely not 20% every acquisition, because it should vary across target companies depending on how well or badly managed they are. So when you think about target companies, what's the value control? You almost have to ask the question, if I ran the company or somebody else ran the company, what would they do differently? Not just on capital structure, but on investment policy and dividend policy. And what you get as a value with somebody else running the company might be much higher than the status quo value, the existing management. That difference is the value control. Any questions before we move on to synergy?
Question.
Yeah.
So if you think that you can make 30 million extra in the value, why would you pay any of it to the...
I haven't said you have to pay it. That is your reservation price. You'll pay up to 90 million. But you make a very good point. If I pay exactly 90 million, what have I just done? I pay the target company stockholders for all the hard work I will have to do to cut costs, which strikes me as insane, right? So when you value control, what do you have to do? You have to negotiate for a share of that value, which means you got to have the 60 million separate from the 30 million that you have as added value. And you say, I need at least 50% of that, 60%, because I do the work of cutting your costs. And if you look at very successful private equity acquirers, often that's what they negotiate for, is a big chunk of the value control. Sammy?
So briefly, I feel like the third test is the only place where you can really find an actual value. Am I getting it right, or?
I'm sorry. There's an actual value for control. The first two were complete illusions, right? The third, you have an actual value. As Perry said, you got to negotiate for a share of that value for your shareholders. You don't want to pay the entire value to the target company, because then they get all the pluses and you get nothing. Sammy, make sense to you?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it does. Thank you.
So now let's talk about synergy. Magical word, right? Now, often one of the synergies we will see people talk about, and Keenan brought this up. I'm sorry, I might have lost you for a minute there. But one of the things that people often talk about in the context of synergy, and Keenan mentioned this, is often you'd see an acquiring company, especially a public company, saying, we're going to acquire another company because we're going to get safer. Our cost of capital is going to go down. In other words, they're arguing that synergy shows up in the discount rate. I'll give you my prayers. I think if there's synergy in M&A, it almost never shows up in the discount rate. It usually shows up in the numerator, in the cash flows and growth rates and costs. So when people talk about having a lower cost of capital after a merger, my reaction, especially if they're two publicly traded companies, is that's not going to happen. Two private businesses might be different, but two public companies, I don't see the potential for synergy in the discount rate. But there are potential costs and growth synergies in a deal, right? So if you can argue that there are growth synergies and cost savings you're going to get from a merger, are there synergies? Absolutely. But let me ask you a variation of the question that Perry asked me. Let's suppose that there is synergy in a deal. You value the synergy. Should you pay that as a premium? Well, if you do, you're giving the target company stockholders all of the benefits of synergy. You're claiming none of it for your shareholders. So I want to talk a little bit about the process of value synergy by looking at all of the different places you can get synergy from, and then perhaps establishing at least a framework for arguing that some of the synergy belongs to you. Eric?
I might be missing something, but on the assumption that betas are intrinsically correlation, as long as they do not move perfectly, like they don't have the same correlation at the same time with the market risk, the risk will come down, even if it's like minuscule, no?
I think the correlation tells you the percentage risk that's market risk, that's captured in the beta. What comes down is not the correlation, it's the 1 month. So basically what will happen is the firm-specific risk in the combined company will be lower than it was in the individual companies.
Sorry,
let's take an example. Let's suppose you have two companies with betas of one, right? They're different businesses, but their betas are one. And let's say both companies have R squares of 20%. So both companies have 80% of their risk being firm specific. You combine the two companies, what's a combined company's beta going to be?
So I was not looking at that correlation. I may be going wrong. Let me reiterate. I was saying that when you say one, you mean when the market moves in one direction, the stock moves in the same direction.
Not much say correlation, right? Because the correlation with the market is what beta captures.
Correct. But let us say if one stock is steel, the other is power, they will never move at the same time with the market. Over time, they can have that one number. No. Yeah, or am I wrong?
It's not going to show up in your beta. It's going to show up in the portion that's not beta.
Okay. Got it.
Yep. So I think that's the difference between public and private companies, because the argument you're making is a private company argument. Why two private companies should be able to merge and gain. But with public companies, that argument kind of falls apart, because you're not gaining anything by having a lower beta by combining the two companies, but you're reducing the firm specific risk. That's what the correlation with the market kind of captures, is the rest of your risk. So now let's talk about synergy. Synergy can take two forms. It can be operating synergy or financial synergy. Operating synergy, the easiest operating synergy to value is economies of scale. What am I talking about? Two steel companies come together, two retail companies come together, and they're able to cut back on their costs, maybe shut down a distribution system, sell off, reduce advertising. Economies of scale are the easiest synergy to value because they show up as cost savings and as higher margins and a higher operating income. You're done. So cut the cost, put it into your operating income, and effectively you get a higher value. Operating synergies can also be growth synergies. They can show up as higher return on capital on new projects. Why? Because a combined company has stronger competitive advantages. The same stronger competitive advantages can also lead you to be able to grow for a longer time period. Remember, we talked about how long can you maintain high growth? Maybe the combined company can grow for a longer period. Or it can be that the combined company can find more projects, which shows up as a higher reinvestment rate. What I'm trying to do is find a number in my valuation to reflect what your potential operating synergy is. So if you combine the two companies, I'm going to ask you, where is your synergy going to show up? Is it going to be lower cost or higher growth? If it's higher growth, where is the higher growth going to come from? Because then I can build it into my valuation. That's operating synergy. Financial synergies are trickier. The biggest source of financial synergy is the reason you should never mention, even if it's the only reason for an acquisition. You know what that is? Taxes. If you're combining two firms because you think you can save on taxes, please don't ever talk about it, because that's like waving the red flag in front of a bull and saying, come and get me. But let's face it, a big chunk of benefits that come from M&A come from taking advantage of the tax law. Let me give you a very simple example. Money-making company buys a money-losing company. You know what the tax benefits are? You can take those losses, especially if they're big NOLs, and claim it against your taxes. You're saving on taxes, and that is your benefit. It could be that you write up your assets. Remember that purchase price allocation that gets done after mergers? Maybe by writing up your assets, you get more depreciation, which saves you taxes. So one reason for acquisitions is tax benefits, but if it's a reason, it's best never left mentioned. It's best never mentioned, because if you mention it, you're asking for trouble. You're asking for questioning. The second potential reason, and this is trickier, this is one of the few reasons why you might have a cost to capital effect even with two public companies. Let's play a game. Let's assume you have two companies, both publicly traded, both at their optimal debt ratios, and their optimal debt ratio is 20%. So each company is borrowed 20%. You compute a cost of capital based on the 20% debt ratio. The two companies combine. When the two companies combine, they become safer. I know the safety doesn't show up in the betas, but that safety might allow them to borrow more money. So actually, when I recompute the optimal for the combined company, it could be 30%. That's a financial synergy. You're able to borrow more. It shows up as a lower cost of capital and a higher value. And here's the only potential scenario where diversification by itself will create value. Let's say you have two private companies, both owned by people who are entirely undiversified. If I combine those two companies, I might actually create value. And here's why. It's not that my market beta is less, but because by combining the two companies, and this is, I think, the argument that Perry was making, which extends to private companies, I've reduced the firm-specific risk. The combined company is going to move more with the market than the individual companies did. It doesn't reduce my beta, but it allows me my total beta that I compute to be a lower number after the deal. this is why I think a lot of family groups, especially the privately owned businesses, will tend to diversify. Because when you diversify, you reduce that diversification penalty that you used to pay by having, but that's with private companies. And that's the only scenario where diversification can become a good reason for doing a valuation, where there's synergy. So operating synergy, financial synergy, no matter what the synergy is, to value synergy, you've got to go through a three-step process. First step, you've got to value the acquiring company and the target company as standalone companies. Notice what I just said. You cannot value synergy by just valuing the acquiring, just valuing the target company. You have to bring the acquiring company into the picture. So value the two companies standing alone, status quo. Step two, just add up those two values, because in a world with no synergy, that's what the combined company's value would be. Step three, value the combined company with all the synergies built in. You know what I mean by synergies built in? You have higher growth and lower cost, build that all in. Value the combined company. And if you're right about synergy, what you get as a value in step three should be greater than the value that you got in step two by just combining the two status quo values. That difference is the value of synergy. So I'll try a very simplistic example to illustrate this. This was about, 15 years ago, when Procter & Gamble, the largest consumer product company in the world then, bought Gillette, sixth largest, huge M&A. And synergy was filled the air, the talk of synergy filled the air. So I decided I was going to value synergy. So here's what I did. I valued Procter & Gamble standing alone and came up with a value for the equity of $221 billion. So I did a traditional DCF of Procter & Gamble status quo, original valuation. I valued Gillette standing alone and came up with a value of about $60 billion. So let me pause right there. I valued Procter & Gamble. I valued Gillette. If there were no synergy involved in this deal, I would just add those two values up. The value I would get for the combined company would just be the sum of those two, which is $281 billion. I call the combined company Piglet, Procter & Gamble, Gillette, but that's not the name they've chose. They continue to be called Procter & Gamble. But that is the combined company with no synergy. Then I said, okay, let me do a best case valuation of synergy. And in a minute, I'll explain why I'm going to call this best case. Here's what I did. I took everything managers said they were going to do at the time of the merger. They talked about cutting costs by $250 million. I assumed they would do it instantaneously. They talked about growing faster. I said, they assumed they could pull that off. So I gave the company lower costs that improved my operating income and higher growth. And I revalued the combined company with the synergy built in at $298 billion. Value the company, no synergy, $281 billion. Value with higher growth and lower cost, $298 billion. The difference between those two values is my best case valuation of synergy. Why best case? Because even if there's synergy, it will almost never show up instantaneously, right? It takes work. What if I told you it would take 5 years for Procter & Gamble to get the synergy? How would I value the synergy? I've come up with the $17 billion. Let's say you agree with that, but you think it'll take 5 years to get that synergy. How would I come up with the value of synergy if I have to wait? What do I have to do?
Do you discount that?
Discount back, add a cost of capital for the combined company. It's one of the few times we use a combined company's cost of capital. I discount $17 billion back, 5 years of the cost of capital, and I probably come up with $13 billion. If I don't think they can pull off the $250 million cost cuts, if they can pull off only $150 million, that will reduce it even further. But here's, I think, the most scary part of this entire deal. You know what Procter & Gamble actually paid as a premium on this deal? They actually paid a $25 billion premium. That, I think, is at the heart of why acquisitions don't create value for acquiring company shareholders. Is your best case valuation of synergy $17 billion? What the heck are you doing paying $25 billion as a premium? Because even if there's synergy there, the target company shareholders have got 130% of the synergy. That's not a good deal for the acquiring company shareholders. Perry, I know you've had your hand up for a moment, so I'm sorry I've been bulldozing through. But do you have a question or from before? Or?
Oh, it's answered. It's answered.
Okay. So the mechanics of value synergy: value the acquiring company, value the target company, add the two up, that'll give you a base, then value the combined company with synergy. I'm going to send you a link after this session on a post I did on InBev buying SAB Miller. So you can see this process play out in a real deal. But that's exactly what you're going to see me do. I'm going to value InBev separately, SAB Miller separately. Then I'm going to value the combined company with all the synergy benefits that people were seeing at the time that that deal was put together, which was 2015. So it's a simple process, but it does require that you go sequential. Any questions on the process? Julieta?
Yeah, would it make sense to add a probability of success to that premium and then factoring, probability of success of the synergy and then weigh that against the premium?
Absolutely. It's an expected value. That's, you know, so when I talk about 250 million, rather than use the 250 million, I should use the expected cost cut. And what I mean by that is we have history on cost cut announcements at mergers. And you know that in a typical merger, only 80% of the cost cuts that are claimed at the time of the merger are actually delivered. So rather than use 250 million, I might use only 200 million. So without even going through a full-fledged probability analysis, you can adjust the numbers to reflect what you think are more reasonable expectations. And I think that makes complete sense.
Professor, can I ask, I'm curious about if a company like Walgreens buys a competitor like CVS, does the synergy account for potential monopoly pricing power?
Yeah, you'd show up as higher margins, but just don't mention it to the antitrust guys. Right? Because that'll be a factor, because if that is your plan, is you plan to buy a CVS and then raise prices, you can show us higher margins, higher cash flows. It'll show up basically in the cash flows. But the problem is monopoly power almost always attracts a blowback. So you've got to be, when you build in expectations, you've got to be careful about that blowback as well.
I may be using your own sword against you here, but isn't like, I'm assuming that you took management communication on what will be the value of synergies. Maybe they are not the entire idea, and like they have tax benefits or they have monopoly power, which they do not want to state to the mass public.
That could be. Maybe they're not stating the reasons, in which case I have to fill in the detail. When Time Warner and I think Comcast were planning a merger a few years ago, it was on, you could see almost entirely driven by pricing power. So when I did the valuation, the management actually talked about strategic, which means they don't want to talk about the real reasons. I had to fill in the gaps. So you got to often fill in the gaps. But if you're a banker involved in this deal, you should be able to talk to the management directly, right? It's
correct.
Yeah. So let's now talk about value and synergy. Let's talk about tax benefits. And let me give you a very simplistic example to illustrate how you'd value tax benefits. Let's say your Best Buy, the electronics retailer, and this was when Zenith had fallen on hard times. And in fact, the only asset that Zenith was bringing to the table was the fact that they'd lost money for a long time. That's a pretty sad state of affairs. But Zenith at one time had a well-known brand name and made TVs, but by the time Best Buy looked at Zenith, all they had as an asset was an NOL of $2 billion. So let's play again. Let's say you're Best Buy. Let's say you're a money-making company, and that we have to add that as a qualifier, and your tax rate is 36%. You're buying Zenith. Its only significant asset is this big NOL of $2 billion. What's the tax benefit, or what's the synergy you should see here? How much is, what's the value of the synergy?
Like the present value of the $720 million?
Well, if you have the income already, then basically you claim the NOL immediately, in which case your tax benefit is going to be 36% of $2 billion, which is $720 million. But Perry, you raised a good point. Who has $2 billion in operating income right away? If you have only $500 million in taxable income each year for the next 4 years, how much is your tax benefit going to be every year? So first year, you have $500 million taxable income, you pay no taxes.
180
in year one, 180 in year two, 180 in year three, 180 in year four. So it's a present value of 180 million every year for the next 4 years. So what discount rate should I use to discount that tax savings back to today? I'll give you the choices. I can use the cost of debt, the cost of equity, or the cost of capital. I can use Best Buy's numbers or Zenith's numbers. What do you think I should use as a discount rate? Where's my risk here?
You would use Best Buy's cost of capital.
And why Best Buy? Because we talked about target company. Why in this case am I not looking at Zenith's?
The benefit depends on the ability of, or in the risk of Best Buy's ability to make profits.
In fact, from the Zenith side, I'm getting the NOL. I have no uncertainty about the NOL. My uncertainty is entirely about Best Buy's income. In fact, I think you can make an argument for either Best Buy's cost of capital. But remember, this is taxable income. It's after interest, or even Best Buy's cost of equity. Either is acceptable depending on how you frame the question, but it has to be Best Buy's discount rate that drives the process, because the uncertainty is about whether you can claim the tax benefit. So any questions on tax benefits? This is sometimes an issue in acquisitions. Is there's an NOL, what do I do about it? And I've seen bankers just multiply the NOL by the tax rate. That works only if you have the income right away to claim the tax benefit. If you don't, then you got to take the present value of your tax benefits over time. And to compute that present value, you've got to look at the risk in the income against which you're going to claim the NOL. So you've got to bring that in. Sammy, go ahead.
Hey, so one thing I didn't understand, assuming that they acquire Zenith, they're going to say that we are losing $2 billion and they're going to divide it into 4 years.
No, you're not losing $2 billion. These are losses from the past that have accumulated. So when you talk about NOLs, you're not talking about future losses. You're talking about losses from the past. That's why there's no uncertainty about the $2 billion. It's already happened.
Okay, wouldn't that affect their annual dividend to shareholders?
Why? It's not a cash flow.
Okay, so it's not, okay.
It's just a pure tax thing, right? So it's just a number in an annual report. You're not paying $2 billion in losses. It's already happened.
Okay, so it only goes to the tax. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I was just worried. I was just in doubt because he said you don't want to state that you're doing this for the taxes, but in a way it's very obvious that it is.
Yeah, you're doing it only for the taxes. But if you're the Best Buy CEO and you're CNBC and say, why are you buying Zenith? You know what you're going to say? Because they have this great brand name and we're going to bring the brand name back. You're lying. If you say we're doing it just for the NOL, the IRS is going to come in and say, you know what? A purely tax motivated transaction, we're going to challenge. It sounds deceptive, but it is, it is what it is. When you motivate an acquisition with taxes, you have to talk around it, because if you talk specifically about taxes, it's going to bring a ton of trouble for you.
That was the question I was going to ask. On what grounds would the IRS block it? And is there any regulation surrounding just acquiring the NOL as an asset?
I can almost guarantee you that this deal is going to get blocked. Because over the last 25 years, the IRS has learned not to allow something like this to go through.
And is that Is that a DOJ thing or the IRS itself?
It's an IRS thing, because they will claim that the only motive for this is taxes, and they'd be absolutely right. And you'd have no standing. That's why when you buy a company, you better have something other than NOL that you can use to at least claim a business motive. And even then, if you're claiming a lot of tax savings from NOLs, they will make you fight for those tax savings. And that's their job. I think they should do that.
Right. And is that not legal? That's explicitly not allowed to just acquire a company for...
In fact, the IRS, the tax law is basically that you need a business motivation to claim a tax benefit on an NOL. So their argument is you bought a shell company with an NOL. There's no business motive.
Got it.
Therefore, they're going to deny it. And they'll be on the right side of the law when they do that.
Cool. Thank you.
Professor, if you can just briefly repeat again, how much would you pay for this acquisition in this case?
It'd be the present value, $180 million every year for the next 4 years. So the present value would be $180 million for the next 4 years, discounted back at Best Buy's cost of capital or even their cost of equity.
Okay. Sorry, why is it only 4 years?
Because at the end of 4 years, you run out of the tax benefit. Right, $500 million.
Right.
4 years.
Thank you,
Professor. Since this is tax benefit, it's almost like kind of after tax income. So shouldn't you use cost of equity for Best Buy?
That's why I said if I could make a reasonable argument for cost of equity, that's why I said taxable income. But you know what, if you make the argument for cost of capital because your debt ratios could be changing and your leverage could be changing, I think you can, I think this is one of those cases where you can make an argument for either cost of capital or cost of equity of Best Buy and get away with it. But I think cost of equity is probably a purer number because it reflects the fact that you need taxable income, not operating income, to cover the NOL. So I think you're technically you're right. The cost of equity would be the right answer. The cost of capital would be that would be close to the right answer.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So don't pay for buzzwords. Synergy is a magical word. People use it as a buzzword. And the reason people overpay for synergy is they often never try to estimate the value of synergy. You might not believe this, but if you're going to work for M&A, it's amazing how often synergy becomes a plug variable. You know what I mean by plug variable? It's what you pay. It's what you use to justify your premium. Why is your premium 30% synergy? Why is it 15% synergy? You have to put some numbers behind these words. Let's talk about pricing. Okay? We talked about pricing earlier in the class, and I said there's nothing wrong with pricing. And let's face it, M&A is a pricing game. Why is it a pricing game? Because by a target company, you got to pay price plus. So I'm going to play the role of a banker again and say, look, forget this DCF stuff. None of us use it in M&A. You have to pay a multiple. And I tell you, I've looked at transaction multiples. You know what transaction multiples are? I look at what other acquirers have paid in my sector. And I said, look, typically in this sector, acquirers pay 5x EBIT. And 5x EBIT is 100 million. Would you be willing to go along? It's a pricing. I've used a multiple. And if you buy the fact that it's a pricing, are you okay paying? Is this a good pricing? Anybody want to try? What defines good in pricing? Did I use the right multiple? Did I pick the right comparables, right? What did I pick as comparables here? Transaction multiples and statistics. And I said a lot of pricing is statistics. One of the first rules is don't create a bias sample. Do you see how using transaction multiples is going to bias you towards overpaying? Because if you use transaction multiples, what you've effectively done is taken the fact that other people overpay on target companies and built it into your deal. And even if I push this out into my terminal year and say, look, don't worry about it, it's 5 years from now, I still have the same problem. And I'm going to use another word that I see in acquisitions used to justify bad deals, which is, hey, don't worry about this. This deal is accretive. What does that mean? When a deal is accretive, what am I talking about?
EPS goes up after...
Earnings per share goes up. So at least in M&A mythology, accretive deals are good because they'll push up your earnings per share. Dilutive deals are bad because they push down your... What a bunch of crap. What does one have to do with the other? I see terrible deals that are accretive and great deals that are dilutive. And here's the reason I think you should push back on both these practices. One is if you're going to do pricing, stop using transaction multiples. Do pricing the right way. Look at the comparables. Do everything you did in conventional pricing. Don't just focus on a subset because it's going to be a biased sample. And if you're pushing it into an exit multiple, you still have the same problem. You still have a biased pricing. So if you're going to do pricing, at least do it right. You know, go through that four-step process, pick a multiple. Don't let a banker pick a multiple because he's going to pick the multiple or she's going to pick the multiple that basically makes the deal go through. You have to be at least open about picking multiples that will give you a better pricing and picking samples that are at the very least unbiased. And don't let this accretion dilution thing get in the way. Because here's the logic behind why bankers look at accretive deals. They argue if your earnings per share goes up, your stock price will also go up. Why? Because your PE ratio is 20. But let's face it, when I go buy a company with a lower PE ratio than mine, it make my deal accretive almost by definition. But if that company has a lower PE ratio, it's probably because it's riskier or lower growth. Going to keep the same PE ratio after this deal. So when you think about accretive or dilutive, I think if I had my druthers, I would drive these words out of M&A because, you know, it really makes bad deals look good because you can you fund a deal with debt. You're more likely to find it in a creative deal. Why? Because you need to issue shares. It makes companies do some really stupid things. By low PE companies fund acquisitions with debt because they're trained to look at, is this deal accretive? So accretive and dilutive mean very little in the context of, is this deal a good deal? So finally, before we kind of hit the last couple of components. So now let me hit you. Go ahead.
Just to recap the last slide. So the idea is just because a deal is mechanically accretive shouldn't necessarily indicate anything, because the reason it's mechanically accretive is because there's something about the target company that reflects its lower P.
In fact, accretion stories almost always have to have a market part of the story. Maybe markets are stupid. They don't see you buying riskier companies. So what do?
You're freezing up a little bit, I think.
So sometimes acquisitions are driven by let's fool the market for a little while longer. But the problem is eventually markets wake up. The problem with accretion and dilution is sooner or later the story is about to catch up.
You're pretty spotty right now. Your audio's tough. So we missed a little bit. That's all good.
I'm saying if the reason you're doing a deal is because it's accretive or dilutive, hoping to fool markets, you might get away with it for a period, but eventually it catches up with you.
Right.
So my audio might still be breaking up, but hopefully that got through.
No, clear enough. Thank you.
Last thing for today before I completely lose my audio. So I find as a banker, I'm getting frustrated with you because you're not falling for any of my ploys. You didn't want to use your company's cost of equity, pay X dollars for synergy that I haven't valued. Once you get this deal through. So you just have to justify the deal, because guess what? If you go back to him and say, we shouldn't do this deal, he's going to fire you or find somebody else to do the deal. So the first thing is, in many deals, if you think about where the motivation for the deal comes from, it comes from the top down. In other words, very few big deals are done because some middle manager wakes up and says, let's go do a deal. So the first is, we've got to bring in CEO egos to the process. And the second is, sometimes you'll be told you have to do this deal as a defensive maneuver. In other words, if you don't do this, somebody else will do it, and then you're going to be in trouble. So I'm going to close with that, because I think those are two very real reasons why companies do deals. One is, top management makes up their mind that ego drives the deal. The second is, deals are sometimes done because you're worried that if you don't do it, somebody else will. I'll give you an example to kind of illustrate this to end the class today. I don't know whether you remember, Walmart bought this company called Flipkart, an online retailer in India, for $21 billion. And when they did this, I actually wrote a blog post calling it the most expensive facelift in history. And you know why Walmart was pressured into buying Flipkart? Because they were worried that Amazon would buy Flipkart. I think Amazon had no intention of doing it, but they put out rumors saying they were interested. And Walmart got so terrified, they went and bought Flipkart for $21 billion. $21 billion for a company which had a terrible business model. I mean, the guys who built up Flipkart were great scalers. They could build up revenues, had no idea how to build a business. They paid $21 billion. Why? Because they were afraid that if they did not do it, Amazon would do it. This is not a great way to run a business. If you get constantly are doing acquisitions for a defensive reason, that if you don't do it, somebody else will, I think you have to re-examine whether this is the business you want to be in. Now, in the case of Walmart, it might be an indication of how bad the basic business model might have become for them to be reaching for growth this way. So when a company says, I'm doing a defensive acquisition, that's a red flag for me that their basic business model is starting to break down. So reality is, CEO egos and defensive acquisitions sometimes motivate acquisitions. But if you're in that spot, you're also in a very bad place in terms of value creation from acquisitions. So I'm going to end with that slide. And any final questions before I sign off? Looked like I might have lost you on the audio. I'll make sure I'll put the recording up with the full audio, because I've been recording it from my side as well. So if you missed the last 5 minutes, you're welcome to come and watch it. Julian?
Yeah, I have a question all the way back to page 88 in the slides.
Yeah. Just tell me what it is. So I'll
answer. So it shows that there's this sort of trend in abnormal returns where originally it's increase and then it decreases. So
you talking about is this the Indian acquirers?
Yep, this is the Indian acquirers. So why wouldn't markets revalue the firm at announcement? Why is there this persistent?
I'll tell you what, when Indian companies first started acquiring non-Indian companies, my audio is breaking up again. When Indian companies first started doing acquisition, there was a sense of nationalistic pride. I think some of that shows up in markets as well. Markets sometimes take a while to understand. And especially because these are the first big acquisitions by Indian companies, I think some of this is just learning. Today, if an Indian company does an acquisition, I wouldn't be surprised if you saw exactly what you predicted, which is markets know right away. So you're going to get something closer to what you see with US companies today. Because people have learned that Indian companies are just as capable of overpaying as US companies are.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense.
Okay, folks, I'm really sorry about the audio towards the end. I've been bundling both my cellular and Wi-Fi, but it still isn't working. So I'm going to try something different, maybe. But I will talk. Sami, you have a final question?
No, I'm just getting ready to say thank you.
Okay. Yeah, take care. I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
See you.